Well, good morning. If you have a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 6. We've been, since January, we've been in the, going through Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and today we're going to continue that as well. Last week, we looked at some teaching of Jesus where he talked about specific things we do that seek to help the world become a better place, and he talked about the ways in which we give to the needy. He talked about prayer, and he talked about fasting, and Jesus' point was that these sorts of things that we're, he assumes we're all engaging in, but these sorts of things aren't done as a spectacular thing to impress other people, that it's really more about becoming a certain kind of person, and that you can pretend to be a certain kind of person and impress everybody and not be that person, or you can maybe not look so impressive, but yet you can be on the path to growth. And that's what I found. I think that when you see somebody who looks like they have it all together, and then you see somebody who looks like they're just fumbling and bumbling around with this thing. In my experience, the times I've fumbled and bumbled have been much more authentic and real, because if we're going to become certain kinds of people, it's going to require not only God's help, but our effort. It's going to require us joining with God to make that happen. And that's a messy process. Growing, being transformed is a messy, messy process. And so actually what Jesus talks about today is kind of connected to this. And it's Jesus is going to talk about our treasure. And what no better day for a sermon on treasure than Mother's Day, right? But what's interesting is I really don't try to talk about this. I try not to talk about money very much. And there's a reason. It's because if you're here for the first time ever and maybe you haven't been to church in a while, as soon as I say the word money, you're going to go, yep, I knew that's what they wanted. All they care about is our money. All they care about is our money. We've already passed the offering bowls. We're not going to do that again. And actually, what I'm talking about today has very little to do with you giving money to us. It has very much to do with what money does to us. And so, you know, I heard somebody call it 1-800-BIG-HAIR. You know, televangelism has made it really difficult to talk about these kind of things in any sort of serious way because people always assume when you hear somebody asking for money, they are going to, you know, use guilt, use manipulation, use your emotions and try to convince you to do something so they can have a bigger yacht or something. And I promise you that's not where we're coming from today. So let's just have a word of prayer, and then we'll get started in Matthew chapter 6. God, as we jump into Jesus' teaching on our treasure, on our wealth, on possessions, on these things that we own but sometimes end up owning us in some way, it's just our prayer that you would make this, help this be clear and help it be focused and help it be something that's helpful. May we respond to the challenge that this presents as your Spirit guides us. May we just do whatever is the right next step for us as you lead us. We ask this in Jesus' name, and everybody said, amen. You know, I don't like to talk about treasure and money and those sorts of things, but the Bible seems to talk about it a lot. And here's just, and I'm going to show you a couple, like, you know, things here. And I didn't find these out. I just checked like 5 sources and they all agreed. So this could be, it's roughly, this is the idea that in the Bible, 1 in every 10 verses in the Gospels, around 288 verses total, is about money. So if you begin reading the Gospels and you begin making jots about every time money or wealth or possessions is mentioned in some way, about 1 every 10 lines is what it'll come out to in the Gospels is a reference to our possessions, to our stuff, to money, to wealth, to something like that. In the Bible, there are roughly a little more than 500 verses on prayer. So if you want to go to the Bible and ask about prayer, you'll find around 500 verses that say the word prayer somewhere. You'll find about less than 500 verses about faith that talk about the need for faith or what faith is. You'll find less than 500. You'll find more than 2,000 verses in the Bible about money, about possessions, and about how we hold those sorts of things in our lives. So when we approach Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, we should not be surprised that he addresses this issue. Now, there are lots of things I think our ancient ancestors got wrong. They believed the earth was flat. They were wrong, right? They believed that the earth was at the center of the universe. They were wrong. They believed if you went just beyond the blue sky and the clouds, you would be in like heaven and you would see angel babies with harps, and they were wrong. What I think they really were right about, though, is that the issue with stuff and money and what it does to us was as true for them, but it's as true for us today as it ever was then. And so I think the reason they focused over 2,000 different verses, the reason they focused so much time, I think I did the math, it's around 15% of the Bible is focused specifically on our stuff. I think the reason they did that is because they knew something about them and they assumed something about us. And that is that we have this propensity, we have this tendency to allow ourselves to be taken over by stuff. We give stuff an inordinate place in our lives way too often. And I think when Jesus, what he speaks to in the Sermon on the Mount today is this idea that there's a way to hold your stuff. There's a way to hold your wealth, a way to hold finances or whatever. There's a way to hold that in an appropriate sort of tension with your life, of your faith and those sorts of things. And then there's a way that kind of messes it all up. And to kind of let the cat out of the bag early in case, you know, you fall asleep or something, I just want you to know what the sermon's about. So we'll go here. Jesus' point here, I think, is that our relationship to our wealth, money, possessions, stuff, whatever word you use, our relationship to all the stuff we have is connected to who we are becoming and to our life with God. You know, I think we like to believe in some way that we are static creatures, that we never change. I was talking to a friend yesterday, and we were talking about how in our brains, we're still 18. Like, that's how we think of ourselves. And I've talked to people who are even older than me. They're, you know, 60, 70 years old. And in their brain, they still feel like that 18, 19, 20-year-old. But when they wake up in the morning and it hurts to get out of bed, you realize you're not there anymore, right? We change. Every moment of life is about change. We always change. You are not the same person now as you were when we began this service. You are changing. Your cells are dying. They're regenerating. Things are happening that they're changing you and transforming you. But the same is true with, like, our character. We don't just become good people that God made us to be. We don't become the kinds of people we're meant to be in the world accidentally. It just doesn't happen. And the reality is that if we never ask questions about how we're becoming who we're becoming, and we just go through life, we will get to the end of our lives, however long or short that may be, and we will be very, disappointed and dissatisfied with what we've left behind. Because character matters, and the way character is formed and the way that sort of thing happens is through our participation. Right? It's through us joining God and what he wants to do. So not only is our stuff connected to who we become, it's connected to our life with God. And Jesus gets really very pointed about that in just a minute. But notice Matthew 16, verse 19. Jesus says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy." Now, older translations, other translations say moth and rust. The word in Greek there just means to eat. So I don't know about you. Rust, I don't find very intimidating. Rats are terrifying, right? So I like that they went with this, because this really gets, you know, your stuff. Don't store up treasure on earth because moths and vermin destroy it and thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. On the surface, this seems just so simple. Jesus makes a very, very kind of obvious comment where the thing that matters the most to you, that's where your intention, that's where your attention, that's where your entire life is going to be. Whatever matters most gets the best of you. It gets the most of you. It gets all of you. And so Jesus kind of just points out that the stuff we tend to focus on, treasures here in this world, whether it's stuff or cars, houses, money, whatever that treasure is for us, it's very, very temporary. He actually points out they're temporal. They are not ultimately dependable. If you live your life based on how well the stock market's doing, one day you're going to feel really great, and the next day you're going to be a bear, right? Because it fluctuates. It goes up and down. And the stuff we have is not going to be ours forever. We may think it is. We may think that we're just going to keep going on and on and on, but the reality is at some point, you and I are going to leave behind our stuff to somebody else, or we're going to leave it behind for somebody else to fight about, at least. We're going to leave our stuff behind. And really, what will matter at that point is not how much of it we had. But I think what will matter is how much of it did we use for good things in the world to do and make the world a better sort of place. So Jesus begins with, hey, the stuff that we so focus on, that we try to get more of all the time, the stuff that we lust after, the stuff that we want so badly, really is like a breath. Because have you realized this? What used to be a lot of money is not a lot of money anymore. I mean, when you read some older histories and you see somebody talks about, like, you know, I mean, there was a time when $1,000 in the world, and still is to some of us, right? But there was a time when $1,000 was like a million. If you would have told me when I was a kid, I was going to give you you're going to give me $1,000, I would have, like, I could buy a mansion, I can have a yacht, I can do all this stuff, right? This is, I remember when I filled up my first tank of gas in my first car when I got my driver's license. It was a 1997 cherry red Chevy Cavalier muscle car, if there ever was a muscle car. And I remember pulling up to the tank pump and filling up that first tank of gas. It was less than 90 cents a gallon. And I paid $10, and I felt like that is so much money to spend on gas. How in the world am I going to, man, I'm so glad I just have to do this once every so often. $10 on gas. There's a million things I want to spend $10 on. Paying for my own gas was not one of them. And can you imagine now if you drove up to the pump tomorrow, if there actually somebody put up a sign that said 90 cents for a tank of gas, there would be riots and street fights. There would be all sorts of things happening. Chaos would reign because we desperately want to go back there. What was a lot of money then doesn't seem like so much money now. And so there is this inconsistency with wealth. What may seem like enough for the rest of your life today may not be enough for the rest of your life tomorrow. And Jesus reminds us that ultimately it's not dependable. It will ultimately disappoint you. And I think Jesus is going on and he's inviting us to be realistic about that. He's inviting us to be realistic about the fact that our stuff really is, it has a finality. It's not going to go on with us anywhere else. It stays here. And it's not even dependable while it's here. I was in walking down the streets of Louisville looking for a good cup of coffee, which I never found. And I was a very frustrated person. And I'm walking down the street and I'm with a friend and we look up and here comes this stretch Hummer limousine down the street. And the first thing I thought was, and he said it out loud, we thought at the same time, you don't really see many of those in Morgantown, do you? But you know what was interesting about that? Immediately when I saw that, I wanted to know one thing. And anybody want to guess what that was? Who is that? Who is that? Who's riding around in a limo? And I think that Jesus is getting to this idea that really we want wealth for two reasons. One is we want wealth for security. We buy into the myth that we're secure. And that is a myth, right? Because what we ultimately want, I think, is more like peace and joy in the sense that life matters. And we look for that in stuff and it really just disappoints. So Jesus says, you know, this is, you know, you want security, but moths and rats eat your stuff. So you can't have security and stuff. And then I think he's talking about this tendency that we have to want to be noticed. We want to be noticed. When you watch somebody, why do we watch the red carpet shows, those of us who do? Besides the fact that we have way too much free time. Like, what is the real reason we watch celebrities in fancy million-dollar gowns with million-dollar jewelry? Why do we watch them walk into a award show that we really care nothing about? Why do they do it? There's a notice thing. We want to be noticed. We want to be seen. We want to, and I think sometimes what Jesus said last week was sometimes people look to be noticed in prayer and religious ritual. They grandstand and do all this religious ritual to be noticed. And I think now what Jesus is getting at is sometimes we want to store up all this stuff because we think if we do, we'll have security. And if we do, people will notice. I mean, if you rent a limousine and drive it around Morgantown for a couple of days, people are going to be wondering who you are and they're going to want to be your best friends, right? They want to ride in that limo. Why is that? Because we want to be noticed. And when we see people who maybe have more than we do, we want to know how they got it, who they are, and why they're doing it. When we talk about these treasures, what are we talking about? Treasures on earth is our stuff, right? It's what we own, our money. But when Jesus says treasure in heaven, what does he mean? And I love what Bruner says about this being noticed. He says, if you understand treasures in heaven, as we usually do, as money only, the context is ignored. The context is the quest for notice, not money. And while it is probably true that the main way humans seek notice is by getting money, the financial quest is by no means the only form of human treasure seeking. We want money because we want the esteem it wins. We want this. Why in the world would somebody who didn't need it trade a smaller house for a bigger house? Why would somebody who didn't need a new car trade a paid-off car for a bigger, better, nicer car? There's a certain, you know, comfort, security, those sorts of things. But ultimately, I think we want to be noticed. We want people to see us and think, man, they're doing well, right? Don't we want people to think that, man, they must be living right. They're living the dream. And so we hear that and we think, Jesus says, don't seek treasure on earth where it is so temporary and you know, unsure. Seek treasure in heaven. And what do we immediately do? We immediately start taking the very things we want on earth and we apply them to the afterlife, right? And so we start taking passages of the Bible, which I really believe were meant to be metaphor and not literal, and we begin literalizing those things. And we think, you know, if I forego seeking treasure on earth, someday I'm going to die, and there are going to be streets of what? Gold, right? And there's going to be all this mansion that we're going to get to move into. And it's like, you know, we'll be on the heaven version of Cribs, and it'll be amazing. And we assume that God is as focused and obsessed with stuff as we are. I think whatever those passages that talk about streets of gold are trying to say, they're not trying to say that God has the same hang-ups we do about stuff. I think, and Jesus even said this last week, treasure, if you pray in secret, God will give you a reward. If you fast in secret, God will give you a reward. What was the reward? God. What if God is the reward? What if the treasure in heaven is not more stuff somewhere else? What if the reward is simply God? And what if it's not about the afterlife so much as it's about what we do right here, right now? What if the treasure we receive, the treasure, because heaven is synonymous with God in the Gospel of Matthew. It means the same thing. If you say treasure in heaven or treasure in God, you can say the same thing. What if the real treasure is a deeper, more intimate, more real relationship with God? And we asked this question last week. Is that enough? Is that enough? If at the end of it all, the one thing you get is not a mansion over the hilltop, but it is an unfettered experience of God's presence, would that be enough? Would that quench whatever it is we're walking around trying to quench? And Jesus continues. He's saying, what if the treasure is gaining what matters more? What if it's a deeper relationship? What if it's not? And if there's no stuff, if there's no price tag on it, if God doesn't give you all your wildest dreams, if you don't give to the needy and God doesn't pull up a Corvette in your driveway, if none of that stuff happens, and all you get is more of God, would that be enough? Jesus continues, and it seems like Jesus is, sometimes, you know, you're listening to a speaker, a preacher, a teacher, something, you can tell when they've gone off script because they start talking about something totally different than what they were talking about. Jesus does that here. He's talking about treasure, and then he says, the eye is the lamp of the body. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever read this before, but when I first read this years ago, I was like, why is he now, why are we talking about eyes? Why have we moved from how we deal with our stuff to eye care? This doesn't seem to go together. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Jesus starts talking about how we see, talks about our eyes. I don't wear glasses as a fashion statement. I wear them because I like to see things. And I know that's probably for most of us. If you have glasses or contacts, you wear them because for me, I'm nearsighted. And so like if I'm reading something up here, I'm going to hold it right here and read it just fine. But if I had my glasses off and there was something written back there, it would be a little fuzzy for me. It's especially bad at night. I was driving home from a graduation party with a friend last night and it got dark and I was driving and I wondered, should I tell him I don't see really good at night? Should I just tell him that I, you know, at night my vision, you know, really decreases and nah, we just went faster and got here quicker. But I need, you know, so I understand that there can be eye issues, but we tend to read this without understanding the context. And if you really dive into the language, the word healthy, that the healthy eye, it's the word haplos, and it means healthy, single, or whole. So it means it's not fragmented. It's not moving in a million different directions. It has a single focus. It's focused in looking at this single thing. It is an eye. It means intention. It means going in a very specific intended direction. And then the other word that's translated unhealthy, it's unhealthy. It's the Greek word poneros, and it means unhealthy. It means really, ultimately, it means evil. How many of you have ever heard of the evil eye? How many of you got that many times as a child when you were doing things you weren't supposed to? In some cultures, that's what it means. In the biblical culture, an evil eye means a stingy eye. It means somebody who has an evil eye. It means they're stingy, they're greedy, they don't share. They're all about getting more and more and more and more stuff. And Jesus says that a generous posture, a generous eye, when you hold your stuff in this specific way, it lets light come into the person. And when you're stingy and greedy and you're not generous, it brings darkness into the person. And the best way I can explain that is to give you a story. My great-grandmother on my mother's side, one of them, she lived, and I say humbly, but I mean, she didn't have like a big house. She lived in a small mobile home outside of my grandmother's property. She didn't have very much stuff. She didn't have a car. We, you know, family would take her everywhere she needed to go. She didn't have, you know, she lived very, like she would eat the same, like she would open a can of corn in the morning, eat half of it, and then eat the rest of it later that day. She didn't want to pay for food. There's actually this one time when my mom went to the grocery store for her and they shorted her a penny and she insisted my mother drive back the 20 miles to get back to the store to get her penny back. I'm pretty sure mom just gave her a penny. But this was, you know, and when she died, they found $10,000 in her freezer and a lot more than that in her bank account. And yet, I mean, she was probably at that point in my life, she was probably the wealthiest person I'd ever known. I didn't know she was wealthy, but she was the wealthiest person I'd known. And yet she's probably, I mean, honestly, she's probably one of the most miserable people I ever came in contact with in my whole life. And it was because she assumed that if she let anybody get close to her, you know what they're going to be after, right? They don't just want to get to know me. They're going to find out I got money and then they're going to start asking for money. And so I've got to keep them at a distance. And she missed out on getting to know her kids, her grandkids, her great grandkids. She missed out on these relationships she could have had because she was simply trying to keep people at a distance because of her stuff. And I'll never forget, I was in my early college years when she died, and I was very sad at her funeral, not because we were close. I was just very sad because I was thinking about all the years and all the joy and all the peace and all the goodness of life that she just missed out on. And I think when Jesus says that a generous person is full of light, what he means is that when you hold your stuff in an appropriate posture, it means when you're not squeezing the life out of it, but when you keep it in its perspective, this is just stuff, can't take it with you. When you keep it in that perspective, you are then free to be generous with others. And that generosity brings about some kind of transformation in us. A generous person, I've known maybe a handful, two handfuls of people in my life who have nailed this. And they have been, some of them were wealthy, some of them were not. But when they had people had needs, they would do anything they could to make sure those needs got met. When people needed something, whether it was money or time, especially even time, they were willing to like derail their lives in order to be there for somebody else. And when I think about those people and I think about the lives they've lived and who they've become, I would say 90% of the time, maybe 100% of the time, that person is more joyful, more compassionate, more full of hope, more full of peace. They have a sense that they're part of something larger than themselves. And when they leave this world, they leave this world and the world misses them sorely because they have made a difference. And the reason they made a difference was because they held their stuff in an appropriate posture. And the people I've known who've done the opposite, who've been stingy and greedy. And by the way, stinginess and greediness are not a rich people, poor people thing. It is a people thing. You can have much and be generous, or you can have little and be stingy. So we're not talking about who has what here. We're saying that there's this propensity in the human heart to want to just hold on. And when we learn to let go, it frees us up to experience things like joy and like relationship. When you're keeping people at a distance because you're afraid they want your stuff, you can never really know them. They can never really know you, and you can never really experience the joy of relationship. Our relationship's messy. Everybody who's ever had a friend says what? Yes. Right? It's messy. It's difficult. But is that the best part of life? I mean, I can think about the times when I look back on with the most fondness in my life aren't the times people were blowing lots of money to do something fun. It was times when we sat and we talked and we laughed so hard that our stomachs hurt. And those are the moments. And being with people in the good times and bad, those are the moments that shape us into who we are. And Jesus says that when you have healthy eyes, it frees you to be this person full of light and generosity and compassion and hope and goodness. And he continues and goes back into this discussion. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You can't serve both God and money. The word master here, by the way, it's the Greek word kurios. It's where we get Lord. This is, I think this is from Jesus, a veiled kind of jab, or from the gospel writers at least, a veiled jab at the Roman Empire. In Jesus' world in the first century, there was one Kyrios, one Lord, and his name was Caesar. And there was this thing, this kind of saying that Caesar demanded of all his subjects, that they would have to say, Kaiser ho Kyrios, and it meant Caesar is Lord. And this was a test of patriotism. It was a test of, really, sometimes it became a test of whether or not you got to buy something to eat or whether or not you got to draw another breath. If you would say Caesar is Lord, Caesar will grant you food. He'll grant you another breath. And so Jesus comes in. The first Christians kind of co-opted this. And when you read this in the Bible and you've seen it on a bumper sticker and you've heard it on a t-shirt and probably seen it on a sign at a ball game, but Jesus is what? Lord. And what does that mean, right? That's a very political way of saying things. It's saying Jesus is Lord and Caesar isn't. And in this section, Jesus is saying either God is Lord, which means kind of the ultimate. He's the ultimate. He's where the buck stops for you. He's what defines you. He's what gives you your sense of meaning and purpose. Like either that or it's your stuff, but you cannot have it both ways. There is either this path of that leads to being filled with more light and hope and peace and joy and goodness, or there's this path that is about shrinking the human spirit because you become simply focused on how much you have or how you keep what you have, and you disconnect yourself from relationship and what matters most. And Jesus essentially lets us choose. We get to pick. And there's a story in the Gospel of Matthew that sums this whole thing up. This rich, and by the way, this follows a story where Jesus takes little babies and blesses them, which I think is a very beautiful image of what we just did on Mother's Day. But a man came to Jesus and said, what must I do? Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life, to get eternal life? We've said this a million times. This phrase originally, this is not about the afterlife. This is about a quality of life that for Jesus listeners, it starts now and extends into the next period, the next life, but it begins in this life. So this is not a, how do I get out of here? This is, while I'm here, how do I live in a certain way so that it's a certain quality of life that then extends forever? Why do you ask me about what is good? Jesus replied, there's only one who is good. If you want to enter life, keep the commandments. Well, which ones? He inquired. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. Honor your father and mother. Love your neighbor as yourself. He deals with five of the 10 commandments that have to do with our relationships with one another. And he leaves out one. Does anybody know which one it was? Don't covet, right? He leaves that one out. And I think that's what Jesus is kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. That's the point. And the man replies to Jesus, I have kept all these since I was young. So just because we're at church and we need some honesty on Mother's Day, how many of you have always, you never dishonored your father and mother, you always honored your father and mother completely? Anybody done that? No. So you could get by with not lying, right? Because you're not lying right now. But yeah, we don't, so this guy's not done this. But he says, I've done all that. And Jesus says, well, if you want to be perfect or complete, go sell all your stuff, sell your possessions, give money to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. When the young man heard this, he went away sad because he had great wealth. The thing about this story that gets me every time is not the interaction between these two. It's that this man drops his head and walks away because the price is too high, and Jesus lets him go. Jesus does not get into negotiations. Well, how about half your stuff? I don't think he's saying this to all of us for all time. I think Jesus gets, like, for this guy in his life right now, if he wants to experience the fullness of joy in life that God can give him, he's got to start from zero. And he's got to get rid of this idol in his life that has become his stuff. And so just as we get ready to wrap up here, just a couple things I think this means for us. Because I think the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus speaks this, he's speaking to people who live 90% in poverty. He's not speaking to middle-class Americans in the wealthiest country, most powerful country the world has ever known. So I think we have to ask different questions other than just what is Jesus saying. We have to ask, how does it apply to us? And I would begin here. I think we have to be on our guard against living our lives as consumers. We live all the time as consumers. That's who we are. We are no longer people. We are a number, right? We are no longer people. We are somebody that somebody else is trying to market something to. We're consumers. We buy all the time. All you have to do is go out and look around. And we all do this, right? It's not just like there are a couple people who are doing this and we're all the right ones over here. We all tend to end up in this kind of vicious cycle of consuming. We need stuff, so we go buy it. People want us to buy new stuff because our old stuff's not as shiny as it used to be, and so we buy it. We are these consumers. We have a consumer mentality. If you just look at what happens when somebody puts something on sale, you'll realize we're all consumers, right? Have you ever been out on the day after Thanksgiving and almost seen a fist fight over pots and pans? Right? There's something off about that, right? There's something off that we need stuff that bad. We're always in the mode of consuming. And online shopping has made that so much easier for me. Now you can buy things and not even leave the house. So you can, like, totally not take a shower and still go shopping. And it's, right? We live in this very consumer-centered world. It's all about consuming. It's all about buying. Everything's about our choices. We get to make choices. We get to choose if we buy this in red or we buy this in blue or if we want the, you know, this version of it or that. We have all these choices because we've been made into consumers. And one of the ways we see that is that we're divorced from production. We are trained for consumption. We're divorced from the stuff that our ancestors knew about, I know nothing about. How many of you are going to go eat something from others after this that involves some sort of meat? Okay, you're going to go eat mystery meat, 90%, I bet. And here's why, because you don't know where it came from, right? We don't know. I have seen where my food has come from twice in my life. Once was at Greg Hampton's house when he did some terrible things to a pig that I saw happen that I still think about. That poor pig. And I ate it anyway. It was really good, but I still felt guilty. And then last year before, Carla's grandfather had cows. And coming from Eastern Kentucky, the first time I went to Carla's parents' house and saw these cows, I was like, oh. Because we don't have those. We have mountains, and they don't have, like, mountain cows yet. There's not, like, a hybrid, the cow who roams the hills. So when I first saw these cows, I'm like, this is amazing. These things are real. They're not just stuff you see on TV. They have these real things called cows, and you can't get really close to them because things just happen. But, you know, they're really these amazing things. And so he had a cow slaughtered, and we got to eat some. And so, like, there were, you know, sometimes we'll be having dinner, and I'm like, this was our friend, and now we're eating him or her or whatever. And but there's something about knowing where your food comes from that makes you connected to it. You're not just part of a consumer. You're part of some sort of process. Every year, this next week, I'm going to plant my little box garden that I do outside of my house, half of which will die the first week, and half of which will be produced very little. But anyway, I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm going to, because it's a neat thing to go out and pick off a tomato and come in and say to your kid, look, well, God, nature, whatever, but we planted this. And look, we have this food now that we didn't buy from anybody, but it grew in our own yard. There's something powerful about that. I mean, some of you remember when people made, like, a lot of people made their own clothes, and I mean, we were connected to things in a way we aren't anymore. And that divorce from the production process or from even asking questions about it. I mean, why are there sweatshops in the world where people are being treated very, very poorly and unfairly in very dangerous conditions? Well, because we're divorced. And when people start asking questions about that process, people think, oh, you're just being a self-right. No. We need to ask those questions about where does stuff come from? Because if we don't know where stuff comes from, then we are simply mindless consumers going about just getting everything we can possibly get for ourselves and not really thinking about what is the cost of this. I'm not talking about how much you paid for it. I'm asking, what is the cost? What is the cost to the environment? What is the cost to these people who are making it? What is the cost? What does this really cost? Because I bet it's not $12.95. Right? So there's a sense of like we've been divorced from this whole process of life, of production, and we've simply been trained to be consumers. Cornel West says, the culture of advanced capitalist American society, the culture of consumption, revolves around the market, around buying and selling. This process turns everything into a commodity and undermines value and meaning in the name of ever-increasing profit. Now, I'll just tell you, the capitalist deal has worked out well for me, and it's worked out well for most of us, right? So there's a sense where when we criticize this, we want to be careful because we don't want to criticize what's made us comfortable. But at the very same time, we have to ask these questions. Are we creating a society where our kids are going to grow up and they're just going to be known as a number? And are we just teaching them the ultimate thing in life is to work hard so you can buy more stuff? Or are we teaching there's some things that are bigger than what you can buy? There's some things that matter more. There's something deeper than owning and procuring things for yourself. And that is living in relationship with other human beings and actually caring about them. And the fact that some of us are hungry is a problem. And the fact that some of us don't have clean water is a problem. And the fact that some of us are being mistreated. You know, it's realizing that all these human beings we live with, they're our brothers and sisters, whether we know them or not. And it's refusing to fall into this system of just seeing everybody as a commodity. And then I think we need to talk about how we speak of time. The word I use most often to say time when I want to hang out with somebody is, hey, let's what? Spend. Let's spend some time with each other, which is a very consumer-driven word, right? Because we spend time like we spend money. And I mean, there's a sense where really when you think about your time, theoretically, you can always make more money, can't you? Hopefully, we can always make more money. But time is this very rare commodity, and we don't get to make more of it. Now, we can dye our hair, and we can have all sorts of things done to make it look like we have more time. But the reality is time is it's very, very, very elusive. And we've even tried to make it something you can buy or sell. And the reality is when you choose to give your time to somebody and you choose to sit down with them and have a conversation or you choose to go on a walk with them, however you do it, what you're saying to them is ultimately you are worth more than money because I can't buy this back. And I think we have to think about time differently. We have to think about time not as a commodity that we're buying and selling, but as something that's very, very, very elusive that we are choosing to give to one another because we care about each other more than we care about our stuff. And then this is kind of the last thing. We got to learn to live in attention. I mean, what tends to happen is when people get up and give talks like this, people who actually have done really well and they have money, they leave feeling guilty about that. And if you're here today and you're done really well with your life and you've made really great choices, and sometimes it's because we made great choices, sometimes it's because, you know, it just happened that way. However, if you're here and you did really well, I don't think you need to feel guilty about that. I think money can do many wonderful things in the world. We were able to raise a little over $5,000 to help our brother Romano have money to buy a church, a building for his church to meet in so that they have a safe place to meet. That's a pretty beautiful thing. We have some of you guys give money on a regular basis so we can take backpack food to the schools so kids who aren't going to get them. I mean, you can do some pretty amazing things with money. We have to learn to live in the tension between money can be this great tool to do many beautiful things in the world, and it can also isolate us from other people. It can isolate us. Amen. Yes, money can isolate us. It can cut us off. When we begin thinking everybody just wants us for our money, everybody, you know, we begin to build these walls. And so we have to ask the question, are we using money as this tool that it is to make the world a better place? Or are we using it to isolate ourselves from the problems of the world so that we don't have to feel so bad about it? Marcus Borg, in one of his commentaries, he says, here's a personal comment. Don't feel guilty if your life has turned out well financially. Be grateful. It is something to be thankful for. But do ponder what it might mean to take seriously God's passion for a transformed world, the kingdom of God, as seen in Jesus. The question for those of us who have some wealth then becomes, how do we use the wealth we have been given to further God's passion for a different kind of world? Am I spending my money keeping the world at the status quo? Or are we spending our money in ways that actually support this transformative vision God has for the world? Right? That's the question. Are we keeping the status quo? Or are we joining God in changing all that? That's what becomes the struggle for us. So I leave us two questions. What's our posture toward our wealth and possessions? I mean, you know what I'd like to say? I really, really like to believe this about myself because I love to believe the best about myself. I don't know if you do that way, you know, feel that way. I love to believe that if I lost everything tomorrow and all I had, I feel like I'm about to sing a Lee Greenwood song. If all I had left at the end of it was like my wife and my son and our family, and that's all we had left. We didn't have any place to live. We didn't have anything to eat. You know, we were really like had nothing. I like to believe that I would just be the happiest person in the world because I have what matters most. I suspect I would actually be very cranky. And I suspect that I would be very, very bitter. And I suspect that I would be very, very angry. And the reality is that we need to be honest about where we are with those things. Because I like to believe I'm this generous, compassionate person who doesn't need stuff. But what I do really does contradict that. And what I think about a lot of times tends to contradict that. So I think we have to just kind of in the presence of God open up and say, God, we invite you to ask us really uncomfortable questions. We invite you to make us think about some really uncomfortable things, like about how we are living in relationship to the stuff we've been given. And is it in an appropriate sort of way that brings light and life to the world, or is it in a way that's shrinking the world down and making it something else? And I think we have to ask the question, are we just mindless consumers? Are we just kind of doing, we're in this rut of just buying and buying and buying, and we're not asking any questions about it. We've kind of become a number, and we're just doing what everybody else does. And I think that's where we find ourselves. We really have some long, hard discussions to have with ourselves, with our family, with our friends, with God. And maybe say, God, how do we break out of this so that we can actually live this life full of light, with good eyes, with healthy eyes, with generous, hopeful, peaceful, joyful eyes? How do we become those kinds of people? And I think this is what Jesus is ultimately trying to show us. So let's have a word of prayer. God, we're thankful for Jesus and his uncomfortable teaching that in our world and in a society and a culture where it's all about how much you have and it's all about getting more and consuming, Jesus' teaching seems like it's foreign to us. And by talking about where our treasure and our hearts are, by talking about what kind of eyes we're seeing the world with, by talking about this idea of two masters, what Jesus invites us to see is that there's a better way. There's a life that can be lived that does not have a dollar sign on it. There's a life can be lived in community with you and community with others. It's not about what we've earned or how much we've made. It's about grace. So wherever we find ourselves, may we really take some time, either today or this week or whenever we find ourselves, just a moment to reflect. May we ask these questions. How are we relating to our stuff? And is it preventing us from relating to others in the way we've been intended to relate to them? And then are we just really these mindless consumers, or is there a way we can break out of this cycle? We ask for your grace. Make that possible. We ask this in the name of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. And everybody said, amen. Let's